place you will be refused the shield for the long night. And as for the rest of the evening, our divine decided to be three short parts. One, just a word or two about the Book of Esther in the Holy. The second part is to be the concluding portion of the Book of Esther, which is the last chapter, which consists only of a few verses, and is the shortest chapter in the book. And the third part is, will comprise the prophecy, which it is our principal obligation to dispense, and that would take place at the synod. Now, with regard to the Book of Esther itself, and after completing a book, one does wish to go over the chapters and over the verses, over the many ideas that have come up into it, and with which we have dealt as we have progressed through this work. And I'm taking what is in reality the very last midrash in the book. And the midrash in the book has a general statement about it. After this all over, after Haman's lady land seeing, after Mordechai and Esther have followed his plan and have now faced all this, after all that, the midrash makes a general comment. And it makes this comment not only for the period of the Book of Esther, but it makes it for all time. And the reason the Midrash does that, and it's very common in the Midrash, is that great ideas and basic ideas and reality is not confined to a particular era or to a particular period of history. It's not confined to any specific event. But if it is something that is real, as far as the workings of our world is concerned, then we can be sure that it will repeat itself often. And so the Midrash makes this general statement. And the statement it makes is as follows. It says that when one goes through the Book of Psalms, one comes across a verse as the follows, which is really a sample of so many verses. And it says, Indu Lelohim Ma Nero Ma Asenho. Say to the Almighty, how awful, how filled with awe are your doings and your deeds. There is something that is no wrong about it. And the word no wrong means overwhelming. We are overwhelmed by the awesomeness of it. We are overwhelmed by the majesty of it. And what is that is so overwhelming about it? Majesty means ilu menagno shelo. That is an Aramaic phrase, which means simply a translation of the Hebrew. How fearful. Takes the word awful and explains it. How fearful are the events that take place in the world. And they are to be regarded as signs. And that is the word in Aramaic, menagnes. They are to be regarded as signs. In other words, they are instruments with which we are able to understand the very workings of history as they apply to you. And then it makes its statement after that brief introduction, and the Midrash says, Ha-ne-her-o-vim, ho-vim et-ho-deh. Those who are sentenced to death, slay those who sentence them to death. The Ha-ne-her-o-vim, ho-vim et-ho-deh. And those who are to be hanged, hang those who were to hang them. Ha-me-shu-ko-im ba-yon, Meshachim es Mashiachim. Those who are actually drowning the sea become those who drown them who were the ones who drowned us. That is what the Midrash says. Now, when the Midrash makes a statement like that, it is one matter to translate it into English or into any other language. It is quite a different matter to understand that Midrash. And Midrash is terrible, and what is so remarkable about terrible, and at the same time so very difficult about terrible, and what makes it so captivating and so fascinating is that the Holy Torah is bound together. It's like one huge jigsaw puzzle with thousands and thousands of pieces. And as one makes one's way through the Torah, which one takes each jigsaw piece, it doesn't make sense. One doesn't know what it is. And as one goes through, there's another jigsaw piece and another jigsaw piece, and suddenly, and this is the first breakthrough, one finds a jigsaw piece that fits in exactly to a jigsaw piece we had before. We see no picture. We don't even see a part of a picture. But there is something there that we believe now we have made a breakthrough, and there must be something to it all. And so there are these thousands and thousands of people. And when one meets the Midrash, the art of understanding the Midrash is being able to link it to something that is to be found in another Midrash, that is perhaps to be found in the Gemara, that is perhaps to be found in Kabbalah, that is perhaps to be found in philosophy, perhaps to be found in the works of Jewish poetry, perhaps to be found in the novelli of the Talmud, perhaps to be found in the analyses of the Talmud, that there is something there that will help us understand. And now there is another Midrash, and this Midrash is a strange Midrash, but something that is very interesting. You will remember that the Song of Triumph that Moshe and the children of Israel, the Bnei Yisrael, said when they came out of the Red Sea, stood on the opposite bank and witnessed them, their pursuers in the middle, following the same track that they had taken, and then before the first one has a chance to reach the eastern shore of the Red Sea, the waters begin to return, and every one of them is drowned. And then the terror tells us, also in the field of the Navy Shore area, that she knows how this. Then Moshe and the children of Israel sang this song. And the Midrash makes a statement and says as follows. Omar Moshe, the Bonu Alomi, Bame Shecho Toti Yefonecho, Bo Ani Mekalpe. Moshe says to Hashem, Almighty, with that very word that I sinned against you, with that very word will I make the necessary reparation, and I will pray. Where did Moshe sin against Hashem? That was when Hashem let him first at the burning bush and told him to go to Paro and speak to Paro and that he must let the Bnei Yisrael go. And Paro listened to Moshe and he said, let the children of Israel go. I know what's the matter. They are lazy. They haven't got enough work to do. I'll give them more work. And from that moment, he increased their labor. The affliction grew considerably worse, and they had really reached the end of all their terror. They were unable to take it. And Moshe goes to the Levitical slave, goes to Hashem and says, Hashem, lo mohare uto lo omaze lo moze shlachto. Why have you made the position worse for this people? You told me to come to them. Why did you send me? Is that the purpose of your sending me, to make it worse for them? If you make it work for him, you could have done it without sending me. You didn't have to send me. And he blames Hashem. No uncertain terms. He blames Hashem. And then he says, who may all the 40 El Paro the Dabel Vit Mecho, Hira Lo Omazel. And since I came to Tehera to plead for this people and to speak in your name, he has made it considerably worse for this people. There has been no development for your people. That is what Moshe says. And he uses the word, who may all the 40. And from then when I came, the literal translation of the word, Umay Oz Borsi, and from then when I came. And now he says, Oz your fear, Moshe, then Moshe. And there is a relationship between the words, Oz then, from when I came. And now, then Moshe says, I came to what I came to blame you, now I come to blame. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that he's using the same word, which just is nonsense. But what it means is, I came to blame, and now I come to praise. But still, that is not the business. And just for the benefit of those who have some knowledge of Hebrew grammar, I would like to explain something to you. Whenever that word "oz" is used, in fact, the Hebrew or biblical Hebrew is always followed by the future. The reason that it's followed by the future is, because what it means when it's followed by the future is, it means that the future is already potentially there before it happens. It is potentially there before it happens. And Moshe says, Umay Oz, and from when I came to Pharaoh, you have made it worse. And then he says, Oz your shield, Moshe, then made it. Here is something very different. And it is only when one has an understanding of the Midrash as a whole, and of the Zamot, that one can really come to grips with it. What Moshe is saying, my sin to you, Almighty, when I came and I blamed you and I said, from the moment that I came, you've made it worse for Pharaoh, Pharaoh's made it worse for the people, what do you mean to tell me? There was something that I didn't realize. And that was that the mere fact that this was happening to the people was already a sign of their deliverance. I didn't see it that way. I just thought that the position was growing worse. I didn't realize that it was growing worse in order that it should become better and the redemption should come. And now I realize something else. I realize that the sea is being split and that we came over on dry land and that the Egyptians who pursued us were drowned. Not that we should be saved for today or for tomorrow, but that we should be saved for all eternity. That is what I realized. And since I realized that, if all your shield may say, then Moshe will think and the future is being used. Because what is taking place today is but a preparation for that which is already potentially there. And Chazal says, so where do we know that there is Moshiach? We know it from this verse. How do we know it from this verse? Because it goes right into the future. It uses the future tense. But it is speaking about the present that holds in it. And now the Midrash at the very end is really employing that idea. Moshe sees that the people are being worse treated by to understand them. And Hashem really says to him, without praying, Moshe, I'm speaking to you and you don't hear, because this is still beyond you. You were to be in bondage for 400 years. The whole bondage has lasted only for 280 years. The worst of all persecution is for a period less than 100 years. So it means that the prophecy is not being fulfilled. The 400 years aren't there. But what you don't understand, Moshe, is that what is missing in quantity can be more than compensated for in quality. That the 400 years can be more than compensated for 400 years of suffering in the type of suffering that has been taking place during the last 80 years. Last 80 years, the last 85 years, starting from the moment when children were taken from their mother's breast and thrown into the water to be drowned, that type of persecution. It wasn't there at the beginning, it wasn't there at the middle. That type of persecution is such that if you endure that, then I cannot let it last for 400 years. I have got to reduce that period. And so what I am doing with the suffering you are seeing, and you don't understand it, Moshe, is in order to reduce the period. And I'm using that suffering that you are suffering in order to reduce it. And that is what the Midrash now says. If we read through the whole book of Esther, the finale is a very interesting one, as is the whole book. The finale tells us about the gallows that Haman erected. Isn't it a little strange that he should erect gallows? When the order goes that Mordecai is to be hung, when the order goes out that the Jews are to be hung, that Mordecai is the one that is to be hung after the Jews are being killed, or whilst the Jews are being killed, that is the time to erect the gallows. How long does it take? But he is shrewd, the common. Mordecai is incredible. He's got to get rid of Mordecai at all costs. And what happens? The king orders his execution, and by the time he erects the gallows, by the time he's ready for the execution, the king has changed his mind already. And he pardons him and gives him a life sentence. And you know what a life sentence means? That in 2 weeks' time he's out of parole. That he's not prepared for that. So he prepares the execution before. It works exactly the reverse way. He doesn't realize that he's erecting the gallows for himself. And why is it necessary to erect the gallows for himself before? And he doesn't realize that. He thinks he's erecting it for Mordecai. He's erecting it for himself. And he says the reason for erecting the gallows is in case the king should change his mind during the time it would take to erect the gallows, he doesn't want to give him that opportunity. What happens? The king hasn't got the opportunity to change his mind to convert his own sentence to one of imprisonment. And he has prepared his own himself. And that is the way that Hashem works. He doesn't bring a punishment on those who persecute the Jews. They bring their own punishment upon themselves. They prepare it for themselves, whatever it might be. And when the Egyptians took those Jewish babes and threw them into the river and drowned them, they were already preparing their own destruction. Neither can they need a measure for measure. That is destiny. Your destruction you've already prepared. Hashem would never have done it. To give people that gift, they prepared. common sin. Self prepared it for himself. That is the way he says. And this is an instrument by which we measure creation. It's very difficult to measure it when we are in the present, unless we have faith, unless we have emunah, and we understand the ways of God as it is explained to us in the Tanakh and in the Midrashim. Then we have an entry into it, and then we have fortifies our faith, and our faith fortifies our reason, and the two go hand in hand together. I'm reading a book now. Perhaps this is the second time I'm reading it. And it's called Wealth and Poverty by a man called Gilder. And Gilder, amongst the many things that he says, thinks very little about the truth. But he does impart and bring a statement that he's often made, that the black in Harlem today are what the Jews were in Harlem at the turn of the century. And here will the Jews have done. That is how well the blacks are doing. What he doesn't say is the reason, what's the reason for it? Gilder doesn't give the reason for it. He doesn't know the Midrash yet. As soon as he knows the Midrash, he'll be able to give the reason for it. The reasoning is, and he says of it, and he speaks about it, and he speaks about it indirectly. The reasoning is, and he says it, but so indirectly, the reason why the Jews of Harlem became the Jews of Manhattan, why they became that one, because there was no anti-discriminatory law of the office. Because there was no affirmative action for Jews, that is why they became. So really, the anti-Semites wanted to keep the Jews out of everything. They put them in prison. And that is an instrument that Hashem uses for his. And if we understand it, it helps us the better to understand things. And should it happen, it can so easily happen that we are in the very midst of an event and it is an upheaval. And it is a soul steering event. And we take the instrument and we don't know how to use it. Should that happen, then at least we have got our experience of the problem. And the experience of the past gives us that emunah. It gives us that trust and that faith. And we know that somehow or other this will work out, that it will be our blessing. Al amachol yichotze chotzeva. La'achim ha'yeshua. Al amachol yichotze chotzeva. Salvation belongs to the Lord. And therefore, his blessing is always on these people's faces, even when it appears that things are demanding. A very modern example, and we still don't understand it all, but we are beginning to understand. Out of what is termed the Holocaust, and I'm not partial to the man, out of what is termed the Holocaust, immediately afterwards, there arises the state of Israel. Of course it would have come. Wouldn't have come as quickly as it did after the Holocaust. Through the effort to destroy, the result was one of building of God's power. And that is the final thought that the Midrash has on the Book of Esther. And as far as the Book of Esther itself is concerned, the last three verses constitute the last chapter, the tenth chapter. And this is the second part of tonight's year. ויות עם המלך אחשוורוש מס על כל האורץ בידי היום. And you will remember that Mordechai after all these events has now been appointed as the king's second in command. And as a result of that, the king of Ahasuerus is able to place a tribute of all the land and the isles of the sea. They have become subsidiary to his kingdom, and they pay tribute to his kingdom by way of taxes. The whole Maaseh of Tohu Vurotohu Uporotas Gdulas Mordechai Asher Gidlo HaMelech. And as regards all the might and the power and the growth of Mordechai and how the king magnified him, is not all this recorded in the books of the chronicles of the kings of the Medes and the Persians? And so the Torah says, not let the people ask to get into those things. We are interested only in details that have great spiritual content and have eternal value. That is politics, and we do not need to call it that. And finally, in Mordechai HaYehudi, Mishnei LaMelech Ahasuerus, it ends up by Mordechai being second in command to King Ahasuerus, the Gadol HaYehudi. And he is the great one of the Jews. So he is the Gadol as far as the Jews are concerned, and he is the Mishnah LaMelech, he is second in command as far as the whole kingdom, as far as the whole land is concerned. The Lord to the Rose Echon, and he is acceptable to the majority of his brethren. And here the Gemara makes the remark, and Rashi explains the remark that he's made in the Gemara. And even Ezra makes a similar remark, but a different remark. And even Ezra says he is acceptable to the majority of his brethren, but not to all, because there's even Ezra. And what the even Ezra is doing, he is really interpreting a piece from the Talmud. And the even Ezra is a reason, and he would never say anything without the authority of the Talmud. And the even Ezra says, because, and he's quoting the Talmud, although he doesn't mention the Talmud. The Talmud says, a leader that is accepted by everybody, and there's quite surely something wrong with the Jews. A leader that is loved by everybody, because there's quite sure there's something wrong with that leadership. A rabbi that is loved by the whole community is not doing well. No question about that at all. That is impossible. There are human jealousies. There's human injustice. It's impossible that that is in any event, everybody's man is no woman's husband. Everybody's man is nobody's man. Everybody's leader is no leader. One cannot be all things to all men. Everything is nothing. He's acceptable that only before. And Rashi gives him another instrument. And Rashi says, there was a section of the people that didn't accept one another. Not because of any failing on their part. And that is the difference between the even Ezra and Rashi. Rashi says, they detested in Mordechai a failing in Mordechai. Being second in command is all very well. When there is a decree by the king, you will jolly well have to be second in command if you don't like it, off with your head. In order to say he's like, he has no alternative. But when he has an alternative, and you can choose between Torah, you can choose between politics, and you choose politics, that's not for us. You have no right to be in that place. Some of you might have heard me say that the question is always asked, how is it that the Rambam was living in Egypt, winter in Palestine as it was then, stay there for a little while, and went back to Egypt, and died in Egypt, and his body was taken and buried in Palestine. What is the reason? And the reason that he's usually given is that he couldn't make a living in Palestine. The Rambam couldn't make a living. Making a living for the Rambam was child's play. He couldn't make a living. Could do anything. Making a living with the Rambam was a joke. The Rambam was a god. The Rambam was a reason he couldn't make a living. The explanation that I'm even trying to give is that the king of Egypt, the caliph of Egypt, realized he couldn't do without him. Couldn't replace him. He gave him permission to go. And then couldn't replace him and sent for him. And the Rambam knew either he comes back or it's all for the head. So he had to come back. Some of you might have heard me tell the story of Rabbi Herzog, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was the successor to Rabbi Cook, a chief rabbi of Israel. In those days, the position was still a great position. And Yaakov Herzog was very involved in the government of Israel. Yaakov was his elder son. And Yaakov in Israel was ambassador to Montreal. And both Rabbi Herzog and his wife were in our home. And everybody had gone already, and they stayed over, and we were having dinner together, and we were at the table, and we were discussing. Our children were very young, and they were telling us how they brought up their children, and we were making notes. And then Rabbi Herzog said, Yaakov, who was then, the diplomatic world was open for him, and there was every chance that Yaakov could become Prime Minister of Israel one day. Rabbi Herzog said, that is not his place. We would rather have him a rov in the smallest village in Israel, and not Prime Minister. We don't want that. And Mrs. Herzog said the same thing. And Yaakov Herzog was a man who every day learned his Talmud, learned his Gemara. And not for an hour or two, a minimum of 4 hours. Every day he studied his Talmud. And Yaakov Herzog became, if you touched him anywhere in the Talmud, he was a Talmud. That's the example. That is an instrument which a Torah Jew uses. Less material, but more spirituality. How can the two compare with one another? And that is the explanation that Rashi gave. They felt that he had no business to be where he was. And then it is just a compliment to Mordechai. Delish and lovers. He was one who thought the good of his people. The Delveil Sholom the whole world, and spoke for the welfare of all his people, of all the seed of his people, of all the children of Israel. And it is of that name that the book of Esther is called. And now, the third part of the evening, I tell you, is set aside for the present. And whatever pleasantries there are all in conformity with Eros. And the first pleasantry, the first pleasant duty that one has to perform is to pay a tribute to one's host in his death. And therefore, on behalf of you all, ladies and gentlemen, I thank Harry and Julie Levine for giving us their home this evening, for being such a gracious host and host guest, and for putting so much heart and soul into everything that has taken place down here. Thank you very much to me and Harry. We all appreciate it. I would like to say to thank those ladies who were actually the conveners for the evening service. They are Sheila Sonnenberg, Jenna Green, and Barbara Wiley. And I would also take the opportunity of thanking all the many ladies who helped me. I know that it wasn't just a few ladies who helped me, but I'm thanking all the many ladies who helped me. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, I have been taught to hate any discrimination. I don't think it's right to discriminate against the woman. And I've been looking around this evening to see what is it that I can say about the men. And of course there is a tremendous amount I can say about them. Howard, thank you very, very much for acting as chef this evening. And thank you to the men who assisted Howard in that task. Well done, Howard. And thank you too. And now, ladies and gentlemen, there is a tribute that I must pay. I pay it in two capacities, one in conjunction with my wife, and it is a tribute that I also pay alone. And it's a tribute that I pay to the ladies who attend this year every year. There are many reasons why one attends this year. If I were to ask anybody, the immediate answer would be, in order to learn. That is perfectly true. That one attends this year in order to learn. I have made it clear, however, on several occasions, that the shiurim that I'm giving at this stage is not a question of imparting knowledge. That is not the idea. The purpose is creating tender personalities, creating personalities that are able to find meaning in life. That is tender. Creating personalities that have a positive attitude to life, and that have a positive approach to life, and have an understanding for life. And from the shiurim, they have the instrument with which they are able to achieve that. And so it is to bring spiritual content, to bring Torah content into the life. That it is a life of meaningfulness that we live. That is the purpose of the shiurim. There is a third purpose also in the shiurim. And I wonder how I can explain that. When in doubt, always go to the Gemara. The Gemara has a very beautiful expression. The Gemara says, Krav l'gabi ihalo, v'idahe. Come close to a person who is anointed. Now I'm using the word anointed because that is the word that is usually used in English. But what it means is, come to a person that has been anointed with perfume, with perfume. And this is something that used to be done very frequently in the ancient world. After the bath, people were massaged, and then they were rubbed with the various perfumes, and they came out smelling very beautiful. And the Gemara says, draw near to a person like that. And then you also smell very nice. And of course, the Gemara isn't speaking about perfume. That is right for ladies and for men who are sitting. The Gemara is speaking about Torah. That is which makes a man attractive. It's Torah. Draw near to a person that has Torah. And you yourself will get something of that. That is the meaning of the Gemara. Krav l'gabi ihalo, v'idahe. I find that here we have a group of ladies. I used to find it very difficult at the beginning when we had very few. and a new member joined the Shia. When she joined the Shia, it took a long time before she was able to let go. Now it's so much easier. And easier for two reasons. The one reason is that those who have been coming to the Shia have been coming to the Shia now for 3.5 years. You know, how long is it?
Four.
4 in October. Those who have been coming to the Shia have been coming nearly 4 years. Some have been coming 3.5, some 3 years. Some have been coming for 2.5 years. But those who have been coming regularly for that time have reached a stage where they are not only integrated, but where they integrate newcomers into the Shia. If I were to get 20 newcomers at one time, of course they wouldn't be integrated into the Shia. But if one newcomer comes, or two, or three newcomers come, they are integrated into the Shia. The perfumery is there, and it must rub off. The tone is there, the attitudes are there, the approach is there, the personalities are there. And it must rub off. And so the Shia begins. Now this means that one comes to the Shia not only to take, not only to receive knowledge and instruction, not only to develop into a similar personality, to possess an approach and an attitude to life, to have content in one's life, that is all taking. But the purpose of the Shia is also that one is living. And in the very beginning, there is taking again. Because what the one has, the other doesn't have. And in this atmosphere of tender amongst the women, in this spirit, there is further development, a spiritual potential. Merely because of what should I call it? The colleagues. The colleagues that come together. The people with the same purpose, with the same desires, who come together and one takes from another and one helps the other. And that is how I see it. And where do I come from? Of course, there were some very difficult times. There were times, I think, when I would have been justified in throwing in the sponge. The only thing I never did, I then did. And so I continue to speak to you. As we said, we broke through, and now we have that we have. Where do I come into all this? I come into it, I get tremendous joy. I get tremendous satisfaction. And therefore, my final tribute is my tribute to you. I thank you for that spiritual satisfaction, that only that joy and that pleasure I have in conducting the Wednesday night meeting. The greatest tribute, of course, goes to my wife. She has borne the brunt, very much of all, and she, together with me, reaped the harvest of our efforts. Thank you, ladies. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for attending this event.
As usual on Wednesday night, the citizens here is over the Ralph says, are there any questions? Sometimes there are questions, but there are always a few announcements coming from the women. Pat and I have our little team orders and chicken orders and meat orders, so we try and take care of our Wednesday night. First of all, I want to thank Julie and Harry for a very, very lovely affair this evening, a lovely setting, a lovely hospitality. We certainly appreciate it and all the hard work that went into it. On behalf of the ladies of the Wednesday Evening Women here, I want to thank the Rob and the Redditions for everything that they have done for us. And as the Ralph says, everything is nothing, and therefore I shall particularize. Thank you, Ralph and Redison, for your time, for your patience, for your friendship, for the attention that you gave to each one of us as individuals, for your patience. And thank you, most of all, for the excitement that you have passed on to us and the reward you have passed on to us and what it is to move forward. On behalf of the women, we have ordered two forums for you. Because you took a 6-week vacation, we were unable to stop the library and see which the forums ordered. Therefore, they are on their way, and we hope to present them to you all for next year. Those of you who heard the Dvar Torah last Shabbos afternoon, when the Rav spoke about the trip to Canada and spoke how Torah was wherever they were going, was very moving. However, this evening I spoke with a Rebbetzin, and it sounds to me like he went on a very different trip. Therefore, for you, Rebbetzin, we'd like verification of where the two of you are. Next time you take a 6-week journey like this, we'd like to present you with a little bit also.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, David. Thank you.
May I reply? I want to explain to you what Neo Canadian Needle is. I speak to you always about reality. And I've seen you, reality is not what you see, but reality is what you didn't see. I didn't see my friends.